With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Oh, welcome back to Heard Tell. We're just talking about family matters because, look, Canada and the U.S., we're neighbors, we're friends, we're family. Family quarrels from time to time. We're going to talk about it with Sabine Benoit, who is not a new face, but is a new name. And thank God for that, because I butchered it last time she was on here. Sorry about that, my friend. Glad to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me back. And I maintain that you didn't do that bad of a job with my old last name. It was perfectly fine.
Well, you went off and got married, so you have my congratulations and my thanks, because Benoit is a lot easier to type into the graphics card. All right, Sabine, why does Canada hate America this week? And give two examples.
We don't hate you. We're just really mad right now.
Well, particularly, why are we mad? We've got a new tariff deadline, which has not expired yet as we're recording this. So I'm sure there's going to be shenanigans going there. We have Doug Ford having an immigration mess that's crossing borders because Doug Ford's going to Doug Ford. We have I'll just lay it on the table, America grifting media and their overseas allies inserting themselves into the Alberta mess. Let's just call that for what that is. Where do you want to start?
I think tariffs is on everybody's mind. We're just a couple days, when we're recording this, we're a couple days from the August 1st tariff deadline. I can talk a little bit about what's going on right now. Basically, the Trump administration's threatened to impose 35% tariffs on a lot of Canadian imports starting August 1st, unless a new agreement is reached. But both sides are telling us that it doesn't look good. So on one side, Trump saying, these negotiations are really low priority for me, don't really care about it. Looks like it's just going to have to happen. On the other side, Carney's also saying things are not looking very good, looking kind of bleak. He wants an agreement that's fair to Canada, and that doesn't always work for the United States. A negotiation that doesn't include tariffs is not looking possible at the moment, I have to be honest. I have been advocating from the beginning that any negotiation has to end with no tariffs, and that's not going to happen, it doesn't seem. Canadian Minister Dominic LeBlanc is in Washington right now negotiating. He's the minister, and I'm going to tell you the title, his job title. It'll tell you a lot about what Canadian priorities are right now. He's the minister responsible for Canada-US trade, intergovernmental affairs, and one Canadian economy. And that's all about interprovincial trade. So we can talk about that later as well, which is kind of important.
Who came up with that title? That's like when South Park does a comedy parody of a Canadian government official. That's the title they would give him. Admit that?
It's really sad. They get longer and longer, and the people think they're more important, but really it's just a long name.
The American government is infamous for its acronyms, but by God, at least we shortened it and made it something catchy. How would you even acronym that bad boy?
I think you have to say, thank you for welcoming the Minister of Canada, U.S. Trade and Regulatory Affairs and one Canadian Mahonery.
And how does that go in French? Because you have to do both.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I'm not going to try that because I don't want Quebecois people to hate me, but...
Well, we know how patient they are, but we're kidding. We love our Quebecers. It goes to the cultural divide a little bit, though, and Carney's had to deal with this since he's came on board. Trudeau went under the train on this because he didn't fully understand it because he is of – look, he's from a different planet than Donald Trump. Let's just be honest about it. He just got ran over by the bullet because he didn't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
This is part of the divide is – Canadian officials are trying to figure out, it's like, no, this is not about the institutions and the titles and the decorum and the product. This is all about, can we interpersonally deal transactionally with Donald Trump or not? And when we do, he treats us pretty well. And when we don't, he treats us pretty badly. It's really that simple, isn't it?
It is. And in the beginning, I had a lot of hope because it seemed like he had a much better relationship with Prime Minister Carney than he did with Justin Trudeau. So I had a lot of hope there. I was thinking, oh, they had a really good first meeting. He seems to really like him. Carney's talking to him in the way that Trump likes to be talked to. And, we just have to do that so that our economy doesn't get destroyed. And inadvertently, we don't want to, with the American economy to get hurt as well, obviously. But of course, we're maintaining that we need to figure out what's happening in Canada. So it looked like it was going well for a while. And now it just seems like it's falling apart. And we haven't exactly been great players in this negotiation either as Canadians. We went and did the digital services tax. We said we're going to impose it, knowing full well that Donald Trump would react negatively to that. So how do you go ahead and do that in the middle of a trade negotiation when you're trying to stay positive with your trade partner? So we're starting to irritate the Americans for no real reason at the end of the day. Like, it's a bit upsetting when you know the harms of tariffs. Like, obviously, as your listeners know, tariffs are just taxes on your own people. It's going to make our lives a lot more difficult. We're already in, you know, a crisis of affordability, a housing crisis. We're having a lot of trouble paying our bills. And for us to impose tariffs on top of that, 35% tariff is going to be really bad. The U.S. makes up 75% of Canada's total exports. And a 35% tariff on Canadian goods is going to shrink our GDP by like 1.5 to 2.5% in a year, within a year. We're looking at 200 to 300,000 jobs at risk, especially in Alberta, Ontario, and Quebec. So this isn't the time to, you know, pretend like, oh, oopsies, we didn't know this was going to upset them. Like, I think we knew, we did it anyway. And with 300,000 jobs on the line, I think we have to be smarter about it.
Let's talk about that media portion and the internet portion of it real quick, because the way Canadians get news, there's always been a lot of, look, 2/3 of all Canadians live within 100 kilometers of the border, or whatever that stat is. It's most of them, right? Especially that belt in the Northeast and down, you know, Montreal to Hamilton to Detroit to Windsor, that area. There's always been media overlap. The internet has made it even more so, because now you don't even have the borders. You do have some reform in Canada where you now have other networks besides just the CBC coming along, including things like News Forum that, full disclosure, I do commentary with.
Yes.
But that's a healthy thing. They do a really good job on stuff like that. So native Canadian media is kind of in its infancy in a lot of ways. And the American media has always been a big part and a big overlap, especially for the population close to the border, for a lot of reasons. If you start tinkering with the internet streaming portion of that, that's a legitimate beef on all sides, because not only is it propaganda and political messaging, that's just kind of the new battlefield for politics in general. So when you're talking about something like Carney versus Trump, and you start dealing with who has domain over that media, and is the Canadian audience going to be able to get American media and vice versa? That really is a pressing issue that is an undercurrent to all the rest of this, whether it's tariffs, whether it's immigration, whether it's the economic stuff and the $1 trillion shared economy that Canada and the U.S. have. That's the undercurrent, is, okay, who's got in charge of the information of it? That's a big issue that needs to be framed in that way, not just in the normal censorship or who controls media and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and I'll remind your American viewers that we're one of the only free market democracies in the world that have a state media. So we have the CBC here, and they are completely funded by the state. And that's, for me, a pretty scary thing.
A term paper in there somewhere about how unhealthy those two statements put together as fact is, but that's just the way it is.
It is. That's the reality here. So it is great that we have our own sort of independent style media. It doesn't even have to be independent. If it's anything outside of the state media, I'm happy. That'd be great. We want to watch what we want to watch, and we like our Netflix. We like our American programming. It's all great. And you know, there's other media issues happening in Canada where we're not allowed to see certain things. We're not allowed to, like, they have to promote Canadian media above American media to, you know, maintain Canadian products, and all of that is silly and, you know, not freedom loving, because people should be able to watch what they want to watch. And if it's popular, then it goes to the top of the list. And if it's not popular, then it doesn't. The digital services tax in particular that we upset our American friends over, basically is just a tax on non-Canadian digital services that have annual incomes of like over $1 billion. They want to pay 3% tax on revenues from Canadian users that are exceeding $20 million. This is all the technicality, but the actual reality is, in very very regular terms, is that Canadians are paying that bill. the corporations aren't going to be paying that tax. So they're expected to pay it retroactively back to 2022. That's like billions of dollars that I will tell you right now, Netflix is not going to pay. It's going to be me paying it. It's going to be everybody who watches Netflix. So if you're living through, as I said before, an affordability crisis right now, that's all you need is like $10 more on your monthly subscription. And that's what we really focused on. That's what we wanted to upset America over. I just don't understand it. So it's not like, yes, the United States is doing a lot wrong in this tariff argument, but we're also doing a lot wrong. And you know, I'm sure you've had people on here talk about supply management before, but that's one of the sticking points for the United States right now. They're upset about supply management. And I agree with the Americans being upset about supply management. I've been upset about supply management before Donald Trump was president. So I've been talking about it for years. And we are throwing away basically our economy to appease the lobbyists that lobby for supply management at this point. That's another issue that Canada is doing, is like propagating rather than actually coming to a negotiation with the United States on this horrendous tariff debacle.
And just to give you one example of how this stuff all starts cascading and overlapping, last time you were on here, we talked about the provinces having their own economies and trying to get a national policy of, you don't even forget open borders with other countries. You can't even get open borders between the provinces. One of the things with the Canada customer sales tax right now is they're trying to figure out how to do the e-commerce part of that. And it's become a huge issue for people that just want to do small business or peer-to-peer transactions. It was so bad, TurboTax Canada had to actually put out a tutorial. This I will link to this because this blew my mind. TurboTax, the tax giant. How do I pay my taxes for e-commerce? And I pulled it up compared to the American one, and it's 3 times longer.
Of course it is.
Just explaining how to try to do it, because they have to explain it for every single province differently.
Yeah.
And they have to explain it, how much the percentage of how much US and the, it sounds like madness.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's,
I want to take the big picture view and go, okay, some of this is growing pains because it's going from the old to the new, and you're not going to do that in one step. There's going to be steps and there's going to be growing pains. So I don't want to just flame through the whole thing. And I know I'm an outside observer and I'm American and whatever, fine. You know, throw your vitriol at me, oh ye the great North. However, looking at that, some of this stuff is just sounds so ridiculous on paper. How does it exist?
It exists because provinces don't talk to each other. That is what is really the issue.
But why? Break that down. Why don't, because the idea of our states not talk, like, yeah, we fuss amongst our states, but you don't really have states. They'll, you know, the Supreme Court, very specific guideline in our system of government, stuff between the states pretty much gets streamlined straight to the court, and the court handles it. Now, it still takes a year or two, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Our system of government is literally built around the states having a revenue and an access way to deal with problems with each other under the federal government. Some of this is systemic. Yeah. It's not even anybody's fault. It's just the way the system in Canada is set up. Nobody's changed it. And now the global marketplace is going, no, we have to change this because we can't keep up. That's really the crisis there. It's not even really anybody's fault. It's just, we got to do something about this. Is that a fair way to lay it out without bashing too many people?
No, I think that's fair. And, you know, our constitution does say that we should be working together at provinces on free trade between provinces. So it's there. It's
good. I'm not a lawyer, but should is not a good legal term.
Yeah. But the problem is that every province finds loopholes that serve their own interests. So each province has, like, one province is a farming province, one province does oil production, one province. So they find loopholes to make sure that their industries are protected. And that just hurts the entire country overall. Our federalism makes it so that the federal government tries to stay out of this as much as possible with every province, lets the provinces do their own thing. But the problem that we end up with, and I'm not advocating that that federal government should have more say with provinces. I think it's good to have that separation for the most part. But the problem is that provinces are doing things in a vacuum, and they're not talking to each other, and they're just trying to appease their own lobby groups. Because as we know, politicians want to get elected. They don't actually look at the long term or the bigger picture. They just say, oh, this lobby group is going to get me a lot of votes. And if I do this, it's going to look really good. And it's going to make me look like I'm thinking like Saskatchewan first, Ontario first. All I care about is the is the prosperity of my province, without looking at the bigger, broader picture for the rest of Canada. But one good thing about this whole trade fiasco we're in, one silver lining is that people are getting extremely serious about interprovincial trade, as we talked about last time. So, and there still are. It wasn't just a blip. I was worried it was a blip and then everybody would just forget about it. But we are moving forward with that. Things are happening. So that's nice. Yeah.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
There's a recent news story that goes to part of the interprovincial stuff in a way that a lot of folks probably don't think about, but my background is actually in transportation, specifically air transportation and freight. Y'all got a bit of an airport mess in Toronto going on, but it actually touches on part of this. Like, look, if you can't fly inside, Canada is a big freaking country geographically. There's not a lot of people, but you got a lot of landmass. Mm-hmm. You ain't walking from Hamilton to Yellowknife. That ain't happening. This is a big country. You have to be able to travel in it, and you need air, you need rail, you need highway systems. People forget the Alcan through Canada is just got completed within my lifetime, as far as paved anyway. There's some infrastructure stuff to Canada, and the air thing that happened in Toronto, there's a labor component, there's an economic component, but it also fits into the rest of this. Is like, are we going to have a national commerce in Canada? And if you don't have air travel, Canada is going to be in trouble because you got to be able to do it, especially when you compare it to your neighbor down South America, where inter-American air travel is just exploded the economy when you look at it over the post-World War II era, especially.
Yeah. Canada's all about protecting itself and its interests. And we're kind of scared all the time to let other people in. And a lot of the problem we have with not being able to fly from Vancouver to Toronto for less than like $1,000 is because we don't really let foreign competition into the conversation in Canada. And then I have a lot of people, when I mention this, they get a little bit afraid, like, oh no, but what happens if like all the Canadian airlines fall apart? Well, we're actually opening up a whole new economy for them to work in. They can start working more in the United States. They can do, interstate travel, which is nice. So by making things like sort of insular in Canada, it makes it really hard for you to go see your grandma in Saskatchewan if you live in Toronto. Like, you want to go visit her for a weekend? Too bad. It's easier to go to Mexico in an all-inclusive for a week. It's probably cheaper or the same price than for you to go visit your grandma. So it's hurting our tourism, like our inter-provincial tourism. Canada's a beautiful country. It's a huge country. It's a beautiful country. I love going to Vancouver. I love going out east as well. It's really, really nice. We've got beautiful things to look at and amazing people to talk to. And we can't do it. Like, you talk to Canadians and like, where have you been? Oh, I've been to Cuba. I've been to Mexico. I've been to the United States. Have you ever been anywhere in Canada? No, because we don't have the competition. We don't have the prices. It's really expensive. So we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot under the guise of protecting ourselves. And it's just not working.
I mean, I'm an outside observer and I'm not a psychiatrist, but if I was going to put Canada on the couch, I'd be like, so on this hand, you're talking about how the provinces aren't getting along and you're having problems with national identity. None of y'all are allowed to hang out or visit each other. Now, I'm just a simple hillbilly kid from down south. By your measurements, we're Appalachians. We're not Southern. That's a different thing, different argument. I'm not an expert, but I think them two things kind of go together. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Would be nice. When I go, like, it's a personal story. When I go to Atlantic Canada, people speak differently. Like, it's a completely different world. They have a different accent. They have a different worldview. I love going there because it's like I'm going somewhere completely different outside of Canada, but it's still inside of Canada. And then you go to Vancouver, the weather's completely different. It's a really nice country. And the only reason I've ever been able to go and explore the country is because my work paid for it. My last job, I was able to travel in Canada for work. I would never have been able to experience that personally. I don't have the money to do that. I don't have $1,000 to go to Vancouver and then try to find an Airbnb that's less than $1,000. That's a housing issue, but it's different. But it's really expensive to vacation in Canada, or just to take a nice time to get to know your country that you've lived in. I know immigrants who have been here 30, 35 years. My own parents, they got here in the 80s and they haven't seen most of Canada. It was just cheaper for them to go to a Mexican all-inclusive for vacation, even though they always talk about how much they want to go see Vancouver. But then they do the math and they're like, oh man, that's really expensive. So it's hard. It makes me sad, especially because we live in such a nice country.
And the funny thing about it is, this is why the tourism spat is hurting, because Canadians travel to America for that exact reason a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah.
This is cheaper for them to go to Disneyland or Myrtle Beach or upstate New York or Vermont. Or if you're in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of them go to Washington State out in the country down there. That's a big tourist thing. Or to go to California or to go to Mexico.
Yeah.
This all goes to, we do this thing with the headlines. And I know you work on the consumer side, so you're a little better at this big picture wise. We just grab the headlines and the policies and kind of slam that into the politics, and we forget these are people, and people make people decisions. And people make people decisions like, oh, well, Vancouver's beautiful, but I can go to Seattle cheaper, you know, or Prince Edward Island is wonderful, but I can go to Myrtle Beach.
Yeah.
Not that those two things are even remotely like, I don't know why I said that, but just for example, these are the real world decisions that real world people make. And then sometimes we get caught up in the policies and the politics and we go, well, I don't understand why this is happening. Well, it's really simple. They're spending their money where they can spend and get the bang for their buck. They're going for convenience. They're going for that. If it was cheaper for them to go to the Yukon than it was to go to Colorado, they'd do it. But it's not. So they don't.
It's true. I agree. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of issues there. I think if we open up the foreign side of things, we let foreign investors in, we can expand our airlines, we can allow for more competition. That's the only way to get out of this. But convincing those in power, convincing policymakers to actually make those choices, they're not going to be immediately popular with Canadians. They're probably not going to explain it correctly. They're not going to make sure that they understand that they're going to be able to travel for less money. It's going to be like a sort of a Canada issue. I don't think it's going to be very popular, so I don't see it changing anytime soon, although I have written a lot about it. I try to get the message out there, but it's difficult. And, you know, the organization I work for, the Consumer Choice Center, we do a lot on airports. Like, we just released an airport index because we really care about consumers being able to have the best time and knowing before they go, like, what airlines are available, what airports are better for them as consumers. So I naturally gravitate towards like what's best for me and my family and my friends and people that just want to travel. And it's not this. It's not this. So it'd be nice if that changed, but I don't see
it. I'm going to be a homer. I love your airport index when they first started doing that a while back. I love this thing because I'm an av geek at heart. Yeah. And I literally lived on the Frankfurt airport because I was stationed at Rhein-Main back when the airbase was on the other side. Now that's the cargo city and terminal C or whatever they're calling it these days. But they tore my house down, literally. It was a dump. They should have. You got Frankfurt too low. Can I pick on you a little bit? I'm biased. That's my second home in Europe. Frankfurt's an outstanding airport. But there's something to be said here. When you look at something like that list and you start looking at the locations on it, man, you got to go for a while before you get to North America.
Yep.
Like, Atlanta's on there.
LA.
You got, you know.
LAX is 6th, Atlanta 17th, and then Toronto's 20th.
But you got a lot of Dubai. You got a lot of Charles de Gaulle. You got a lot of Singapore and Bangkok. Tokyo's its own thing because the Japanese can just run anything like clockwork. I don't think they should have their own category for stuff like this. Trains and airports, they just do it better than everybody else. And we just need to admit it. Like,
oh, yeah.
Give them the legacy award and then let's decide it amongst everybody else. Right.
Sure.
But putting that aside, when you're looking at a list like the airport index, yeah, it's the major cities of the world. But what you're really looking at is how the major cities of the world interconnect with each other.
Yeah.
And that's what's so striking when you look at this list and you look at the economics and you look at the policy is it's not just Tokyo and Barcelona and Charles de Gaulle, which is that's the Paris airport for those of you from Logan. Dubai, of course, because just the money involved in Jeddah and all those. These are where the money and the movers and the shakers and the economic decision makers, what you're really seeing is the DNA of the world economy here, because the reason Dubai is going up the list is because everybody in London is going to Dubai to invest and spend money. The reason Tokyo is up there is because Tokyo is the center of the Asian financial world. Yeah. The reason you see, you know, Spain and Paris, it's not just because they're traditional major cities. Spain is becoming more of a tech power. Paris is becoming more of a diplomatic thing all of a sudden. What you're really seeing with an airport index is the DNA of how the world's working.
That's a really good way to put it. I think that's really true. I mean, we are looking at things that have to do with not just the economy and how it's working. It's just the ability for those airports to actually give customers and consumers the things that they actually want. For example, shops and restaurants. I know it sounds kind of not that important, but it actually really is important, the variety that you have. And when you're looking at places like, let's go with LAX, you know, they've got close to 200 shops and restaurants. Sounds great. But then an airport like Tokyo has 400 and Singapore has 550. Like, it's a significant jump. It's not just a little bit more. It's a lot more. It's more, it's like double, more than double when it comes to Singapore. So things like that actually make a difference for a consumer that's stuck at an airport or have a lot of delays. It also affects the world economy. Like, if you're a business person and you want to fly out of, let's say, Toronto, you are delayed. You are there for the night because of the restrictions they have, the nighttime restrictions that they have imposed. So how can you be like a successful business person trying to go around and make deals and do all this business related stuff, and you can't even find another flight to get you somewhere when your flight gets canceled or delayed, or when the Toronto Pearson Airport is shocked, I tell you, that there is snow in the winter. They don't know what to do. This is Toronto. There's going to be snow. There's going to be a snowstorm. And then they just freak out and say, oh, we don't have any spots. We could never have thought that this would happen. So you're just delayed for the next day or 2 days from now. I myself have been in that position where my airline told me, oh, well, too bad, you're leaving in 3 days. I'm like, where am I supposed to go? Like, I don't have a hotel for the next 3 days. You want me to just sit here? And I had to do the work myself to figure out an alternative route. And that's an airline's issue, not just, it's an airport issue, sorry, not an airline issue necessarily. So, you know, when it comes to the economy, you're saying it shows the world economy, yes. And it also shows how much the business world is hindered. If you want to make the economy better, you're going to have to leave tomorrow to do that. So,
rather than on some merchandise somewhere.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Sabine's joining us from Consumers Choice Center. She talks about Canada and North American policy. Let's talk about two international issues that, look, Canada is forever going to be tied to England and France. England, because they're still technically a Commonwealth country. France, because y'all speak a whole lot of French for reasons that we won't get into right now. But y'all like it, so, you know, more go with you. The UK is now embroidered. We already talked about the tech stuff a little bit. The UK has absolutely embroiled themselves with this Online Safety Act. And because of the closeness in the parliaments and the system of government, plenty of Canadian voices want to give this thing a whirl, and plenty of Canadian voices like y'all's, because I know most of the people you work with, know that this is a really bad idea. And communist China has been trying to do it with total control of their society, and they can't figure out how to make it work. So good luck with a Western country doing it, because we have these things called VPNs, guys. It's not going to work, but they're going to keep trying it. I know the Canadian government is looking at this thing, and Carney's position has basically been, we've got more important things to worry about right now. And like Keir Starmer, who's looking for anything to distract from the fact that it's not going well.
Yes.
But this is not going away, and people are going to keep talking about it. Does seeing the struggle and the backlash in the UK tamper it down in Canada, how they're viewing this issue?
I don't think so. I think if you're somebody who wants to protect people in this way, or protect children in this way, then you're going to have that opinion. If you think that freedom is important, even though you think children should be protected, as which is our position, of course, we should have that protection for kids. We don't want them to land places that they shouldn't land on the internet. But when it comes to adults, it's very difficult for an organization like ours to say this is a good idea, because it's really clamping down on your privacy. It's taking your personal information. So if you're on that side of thinking maybe my personal information should not be collected by the government, that's going to be your position. I don't think it's really making that much of a splash in Canada, to be honest. There have always been advocates here for more safety on the internet, which means less privacy. And there's always been people like us who are saying, well, wait a second, this is not as good as you make it sound. And I think that's not going to change anytime soon, honestly.
So Australia is, as we're speaking just today and yesterday, depending on when you get to watch this, Australia is going to take a spin at banning under 16-year-olds from making YouTube accounts. Now, I'm saying that very carefully because it's getting pitched as they're banning them from YouTube. They're saying 16 and under, you can't make an account. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We all know how that's going to go. But the people are trying to pitch it like they're banning it from the kids when they're not really. And the people that don't want it are saying they're banning it from kids when they're not really. Everybody's kind of using this for their own purposes. So even with all that said, I think back to a few years ago, one of our writers at Ordinary Times was going to do business in China. So I wrote a post and posted it criticizing Xi Jinping just to see if he could read it when he was in China as a Westerner with a little bit more freedom than the Chinese people do. And he couldn't watch it without extraordinary measures that we won't reveal here. But he's like, no, normally I would not have been able to see it. We tested it to see. You and me talking about Canadian politics should be available to 16-year-olds in Canada and Australia, right? Like that seems really basic to me. Part of this is I don't think people understand that YouTube is not just silly videos, although that's a lot of it, especially with shorts. YouTube's the number one news way for most people now. They get most of their news. In America, Pew Research did this. YouTube is more important for news than any of the networks and most of them combined. Same thing in overseas countries. I don't think restricting YouTube, which is the new television, that's what it is. It's the new television. It's YouTube. That's how the youths all do it. I don't think restricting YouTube is where it's at. Where do you fall on it?
I think prohibition doesn't work. That's where I fall on all of these topics. I mean, you're taking prohibitionary measures, like saying you can't create an account. And as you said, like a wink, whatever. But like, I don't understand how they think this is going to work. I don't understand it genuinely. Do they think that not making an account is going to make it less likely for them to watch YouTube? Do they think that they're not going to be able to find ways to make an account? Have they heard of VPNs, as you said earlier? Like, I don't understand. It seems to me like it's just we did something. Government often does things that makes it sound like we did something. Look at us. We did this thing that's not useful in any way. It's not going to work, but we did it. And it's just, that's just really where we're falling. Like, just look at history. Every time we try to prohibit something or make it something bad, there's a black market for it. There's an underground for it. And this is going to be no different. There has been a lot of policies to stop people from seeing news. And that's essentially what this is at the end of the day, as you were saying. And that makes me really uncomfortable. I don't understand. At the end of the day, where are they going to get their information from? Are we pushing them more into niches on the internet where perhaps they become more radicalized, either on the left or the right? Is that what we really want to see? We want to see like groups forming more, like getting a more internalized, but getting more niche. I don't know if that's the way we want to go, especially with the rise of, in my opinion, the rise of fanaticism on both sides of the political spectrum. That's really where it's going to end. And that's really where it ends when you stop people from being able to get information.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Traditionally, Canada hasn't had a huge problem with radicalism, although there's been incidences over the years. You can pick plenty of things. We'll set the whole Quebec thing to aside because that's its own thing. We'll talk about that some other time because it's Quebec and my French isn't good. So we'll talk about that some other time. But broadly speaking, separatism and nationalism and the things that a lot of countries, Canada dealing with that, this is a very new thing. And we saw what happened with the trucker protest, and we just had the conviction with the leadership of that. Now we have the Alberta separation thing, which has all sorts of bad folks. If you think that's a grassroots legitimate thing that popped out of nowhere, I'm sorry, you're just not paying attention. It's not. this is going to be more and more of a thing. And part of it goes to what you just talked about. When you have a little bit of a lag in national identity, and I know there was the rally around the flag moment around Donald Trump, but that you can't build a national identity around Donald Trump. When you have these issues and you have these divides between the provinces, inevitably this is what's going to start happening, and you're going to have these siloed radical people. Canada has a different system, though, because you have a parliamentary system and you have a different media system because you have state-run media and more restrictions. What do you do about trying to find a healthy patriotism without it going into the darker parts of nationalism that history tells us goes to some really bad places in a big hurry and brings all kinds of bad with it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think we've seen recently with the rally around the flag, as you called it earlier, that people are actually coming together from the left and the right saying, like, this is not right. And what makes me really happy is people are realizing that free trade is a good thing. This is nice too. It isn't just rallying around the flag. It's like, Canadian free trade is actually a good thing. It makes us more prosperous. Well, gee, that's nice to be hearing more and more these days. But it is happening because people are upset that Canada's being, ignored or looked at negatively. So I think that I don't want it to be a rally around the flag thing. I would prefer that this isn't happening at all, to be honest with you. I think nationalism can be a good thing to make people say things like free trade is good because we want Canada to be strong. We want our economy to be strong. We want people in Canada to be able to afford groceries and afford housing. There is, however, like sort of a dark side to nationalism, as you were saying. When we look at things like housing, I just mentioned housing. That's one of the things right now in Canada, across the country, that's making people a little bit more xenophobic. I'm going to put it that way. People are blaming immigrants for the housing crisis in Canada. You could see it on every forum, every comment section. It's really depressing. People are really upset about immigration. They want to shut it down. That's going to destroy our economy. There's like no question about that. If we completely shut down immigration, if we lower it so that we can figure out what's going on with housing, that has to be a very short period because our economy literally relies completely on immigration. Like, one third of our business owners are immigrants in this country. We have an aging population. We need immigrants. There is that xenophobia that's coming from housing, but also just from the zeitgeist, just from like the cultural move towards anti-immigrant sentiment. And we are feeling it in Canada. So that's the kind of nationalism you really don't want to see. You talked about separatism. So obviously we have a rich history in Canada of having to deal with Quebec separatism. Now we're looking at Western separatism. And in Canada, it's a bit interesting because we do have that Western identity that people have. Like, they're different than the rest of Canada. And they are. They have different experiences. And they've been getting the short end of the stick a lot of the time from Ottawa when it comes to things like pipelines to oil, the oil sands, things like that. So I understand where they're coming from. It's just like not helpful though. This is not the conversation I wish we were having when it comes to the West. We should be talking about pipelines. We should be talking about making the West more prosperous. Now that the United States is abandoning us when it comes to trade and our similar economies, we have to start making the West stronger. That's something we should be doing, but separatism isn't the way to do that, in my opinion. Although they have the right to ask that question and to make that claim, they have every right to do that. It's just not, I think, the most useful thing right now when we're dealing with this entire tariff issue that's hurting the whole country.
Part of what happened there is, and not to condone it, but we got to back up and walk through what actually happened, though. This is just the recent history of it. You can go back a lot further because the housing crisis is entering year 20, really, if you want to go back to when it really started cranking. Oh, yeah. This has been about 20 years, especially in the Toronto area, which is the epicenter of it. You go back about 20 years is when this thing really kicked off. Justin Trudeau, when he was premier, in a response to COVID, when everybody's already hyped up and everybody's already mad and everybody's already upset, that's the moment he decided to do a big immigration push, was right at the heart of COVID. And I understand why he was trying to do it. Like you said, he's like, we're an immigrant-based economy. The economy's taking a huge hit. He was in political trouble. That's when he brought it up. Mm-hmm. But that also made the perfect breeding ground at the perfect moment when people were already upset for the bad faith people to just point at all the immigrants and blame them and blame Trudeau and yada, yada, yada. And we all know how those sort of things go.
Yeah.
That's the background on that. But what has happened now is, as the housing crisis, which is multi-layered, multi-dimensional, and has no one quick, easy fix. Let's all be adults here. There's no one quick, easy fix to the Canadian housing crisis, American housing crisis, UK housing crisis. Housing's multi-level. There's multiple things to fix it. But what's happened now is people, especially in the online political realm, they almost have this drumbeat cadence now of every time you say housing, you say immigrants. It's almost Pavlovian.
Oh, yeah.
It's housing crisis. Well, it's the immigrant. No, the immigrants are not buying $800,000 lofts up in Toronto. That's not how that works. That's not what caused that. That's not the problem. But it's almost become the automatic go-to. That's really the danger of that kind of rhetoric, is now you can't separate those two policies, even though they have a little bit of overlap. But in the discussion, you can't get away from it now.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the legacies of Justin Trudeau is ending the consensus in Canada about immigration. There has been a consensus that immigration is good in Canada. That's something that differentiates us from a lot of other countries, that we actually like immigration. We're very pro-immigration. And we think multiculturalism and diversity is really great. And then all of a sudden we don't anymore, because we can't afford our groceries. We can't afford to move. We want to grow our families, and we are not able to find a home to be able to do that. So your life plans are on hold. It makes you really upset. So he did affect that in that way. The problem is that the OECD has shown us that politicians knew this crisis was a crisis in 2010, as you said. 2010, they already knew this was a problem. What did they do? Absolutely nothing. They didn't do anything to make it better. They didn't change the policies. They didn't change zoning policies. They didn't make things easier for developers to actually build. If it's a supply issue because immigrants are coming, taking all the homes or whatever. Okay, well, why didn't we start dealing with this in 2010 when this was an actual problem? Well, because they just didn't. And now it's really easy to scapegoat immigrants because they're vulnerable and they're easy to point the finger at. And what they're really doing is giving themselves temporary reprieve from the blame from Canadians, but causing a problem that we might not be able to take back for a very long time, and that people are turning on immigration in Canada. And that's really sad for the individuals involved that are getting the brunt of this, but also for our economy. So it's really very sad. I mean, things are starting to change now because it is a housing crisis. People are starting to change zoning laws, but only because they have to. They've been pushed so hard into it that they have to do it. And we still have Canadians saying, we want to keep our neighborhood character or whatever. Like, okay, your neighborhood character is really important and all that, but like, people don't have somewhere to live. People don't have places to expand their families. We don't have places for people to live. And so the federal government is another thing, another aspect of this. The federal government is trying to lessen temporary immigration in order to fight this housing crisis. But temporary immigration is students and temporary foreign workers. Temporary foreign workers are often agricultural workers that work and live in the same place. They have housing provided to them. And then students are people who pay, international students pay $40,000-$50,000 a year, like three or four times more money than the domestic student does. And yet the universities are not using that money to build housing for them. Like, it's just not the place you should be looking. it's just difficult. Because then you see that downloading onto the populace, which is getting really upset because they think the immigrants are taking their homes, and there's just not anywhere to live. But there isn't anywhere to live. They have the point. I take the point. We need more supply.
And this brings our conversation full circle, though, is because one of the economic realities of Canada, especially in places like Toronto, Vancouver, Calgary, the built-up cities, places that already are a little bit more international, have international money, whether it's because of tourism or commerce or oil, if you're out west, that's kind of the natural resources out west is part of that character you're talking about. Mm-hmm. that's part of the problem is Canada, because it's a country of 30 million odd people, there's no way you're going to have massive building without foreign investment. Yeah. But foreign investment is a very sticky issue. And all this comes back to full circle again of Canada trying to decide what it wants to be as a country of, okay, are we going to have this foreign investment, but do we really want China coming in and spending a lot of infrastructure money because we know that has problems? Do we want European money? Do we want American money? Because your friend of mine, David Clement, he told me years ago when I first started doing Canadian studies, like, remember the first principle of Canadian politics is don't be America. That's the number one rule. Are we going to have American investment because that's the natural partnership for a lot of this stuff? That's one of those fundamental issues. And I've been doing Canadian media for a while. Boy, they don't like to talk about that subject. Mm-mm. But kind of like immigration, if you're going to have a welfare state, you got to have immigration to have enough people to pay for the welfare state. That's just the math of it. If you're going to have massive housing and infrastructure improvement projects, you're going to have foreign investment and public partner partnerships. And it's not only that they're not doing it. My Canadian friends, policy-wise, they don't like talking about it. And maybe it's just because I'm an American and I'm an outsider, and that's fair. They don't even like discussing it, let alone trying to do it. It seems like that's almost a mental block on some of this. Is that fair or is that out of bounds?
Oh, absolutely. It's not just because you're an American. This is just something that people don't talk about. And it goes back to, you know, we talked about this earlier in the conversation about how insular Canada really is, sadly, that we are all about, like with the airlines, we don't like foreign investment, just like we don't like foreign investment and housing. And then 10 years later, we're like, what happened? How could we possibly be in this crisis, this housing crisis? We could never have seen it happen. There were no solutions whatsoever. Well, that's not true. We've been saying for 10 years that this might be a good solution. This sense of insularness is really, I don't even know if that's a word. The sense of being so insular is really shooting ourselves in the foot in so many different industries. And making life so much harder and so much more expensive for Canadians. And then we say, oh, how could we be in an affordability crisis? Well, there's a lot of good reasons, and that's one of them.
When you were last on the program, I went and looked when we did all the clips for YouTube and all that. Do you know what the number one clip was from our prior conversation? Well, it goes to affordability, which is an important topic. My proposal that we could solve a lot of this by putting Waffle House in Canada was the most viewed clip from that. And I'm shamelessly doing it again to try to get some more clicks. But that was the number one clip. Just to put something a little lighter on here is like my idea that we should export Waffle House to Canada. I think that would bring goodwill and a shared culture. I don't know if we can do poutine and hash browns in the same place without, you know, the earth splitting in half. We could maybe give it a shot. I don't know.
Hash brown poutines are a thing, Andrew. I've had.
No. Those are two different things. Those are different.
All right.
Let's keep this friendly. Okay. No, I'm kidding. All right. On a lighter note, I hate to bring it up. I don't want to bring it up. I don't like being this kind of person or this kind of media personality. But look, we have to be professional about this. We're going to get through this as professionals because your country, Canada, needs it. My country, America, needs it. We've got to cover this in a responsible, sober manner in the way that this issue requires us, the heft, the gravitas, if you will. What's the French word for gravitas? I have no idea. Lee Heavy, maybe. Justin Trudeau went on a date with Katy Perry. What do we make of this?
I mean, they're both single, so go get it. Why not?
Why not? Oh, let me count the ways. The internet has enough problems right now.
It was the biggest story yesterday, I have to say, in my feed. People were freaking out. They're both single. Xavier, his son, needs to get into the music biz. He's trying to get into the music biz. You know, maybe she can help him out.
So the version I heard was, of course, everybody's thinking it's a date or whatever. I had heard that there's business connections because of the son. When I looked into it, that's what I got told. It was like, there was business connections, and if it's more than that, we'll have to see. That's the version I got.
Exactly, exactly.
The internet version, however, was people losing their ever-loving little minds. But
they really did.
That's the international, very online folks who are always looking for weird stuff to do with this. But how did Canadians do it? Because Trudeau is almost viewed, I'll say this carefully, and I don't mean this as an insult, I just mean it as a reality. Trudeau was always viewed by Canadians and the international community almost in the French version of viewing a national leader. They really didn't care about his personal life. And I'm tiptoeing around some stuff I just don't want to get into over the 10 years of his career, because that's between him and his family, and I don't really care at all. But that stuff's all been out there for a while, and people just left it alone because the attitude's different than the American attitudes towards such things. And I understand Donald Trump's now our president, so I don't think I can even say that anymore, but you get what I'm saying. I don't know that they really cared about it, but how did it play in Canada compared to the internet's just losing their minds over this thing?
Oh, people were going crazy. Canadians are going crazy about it too, because and the thing about Justin Trudeau is he just like shows up at like a Home Hardware, you know, or like a Home Depot or something, and he's like I'm building this thing. No, he's just like living his best life now, and you know, we're happy for him. Just stay away from politics, live your best life, you know, date Katy Perry, we're good with it. But we were going a little bit crazy over it. I personally sent it to the group chat, my work group chat, and I said, big U.S. Canada development. Katy Perry and Justin Trudeau might save us. You know, you never know. Maybe we're friends again now.
Because I have friends that work there, I so want to know some of those responses, but I won't ask out of perpetuity. I will respect the confidentiality of the group chat, but I so want to name drop three or four people. Like, I want to know what they said about that. And I want to know right now, because I have good friends there that I love. Sabin Benoit, this is fun stuff. Heavy issues. We got to have a little bit of fun on the back end of it, though, because, you know, this stuff gets too heavy. We will have you back, definitely, because I don't think Trump's done poking at Canada back and forth. And I want to leave it on this, though, because I got a little bit of a theory going, because people are like, well, all the tariffs, but the stock market's okay and the economy's mostly okay, although it's dipping in GDP and that sort of thing. We had a strong economic report just come out. I got a bit of a theory I want to run by you, though, is I think both Canadians and Americans in the world, though, I do think there's a little bit of sobriety with the Donald Trump and the tariff stuff of it's bad and it's chaos. But one of the reasons I don't think it's biting the way the economists thought it might and some of the pundits did, and I'm one of them, I've been wrong, and I'm glad I was, because we don't need economic trouble.
Yes.
I think there's a good hard strand under this of it's Trump and he's going to change it in 6 weeks to 3 months anyway, so let's not overreact. I think that's a very real thing with some of this. So even like this August deadline that's coming up as we're recording this, it's not the freak out that we saw back in February and March, because I think people are like, yeah, he'll do this again in October.
Yeah.
When the fiscal year changes. I think there's a strand of that, and it's unfortunate that that's where we're at, but it may be the least bad option going. And that may be why some of this has been defying expectations. Do you think I'm off base?
No, I mean, I don't personally, I mean, I look at this stuff every day. It's my job to know what's going on. And I can tell you, I don't know what's going to happen August 1st. I don't have any indication. This isn't business as usual in politics. It hasn't been for a long time. So it's true that we don't know what's going to happen. And it's true that it might be the thing affecting the economy. The American economy is also pretty diverse, right? So like Canada makes up a lot of that economy, but they have diversified their economy. So it is not going to hurt them as much as perhaps it might Canada, but it is still going to hurt the economy, and that's always a bad thing. But we'll see what happens August 1st. I can't tell you. It might end up being that there's a 35% tariff on everything except for the CUSMA stuff. It could be that there's no tariffs. It could be that there's even more than 35%. I don't know. Or maybe they're going to extend the date again, because they seem to do that a lot. So the August 1st date will be now August 15 or something. I don't know. We'll see. And I'd love to come back and talk to you about it post August 1st.
Yeah, we'll definitely have you back. But I think what you just said is important is, you know, I've written this before just as a funny line, but it's actually true. It's like the most amazing thing of the American economy is we can't screw it up even when we're trying really hard to do it. Like overall, like it has its dips, you know, 2008 and that kind of really ugly stuff post 9/11, which was nobody's fault. It just is what it is. The amazing thing about the American economy, it's almost like the more you screw with it, it shows how resilient it is. No matter how stupid our leadership is, it just keeps chugging along. And whether it's, you know, 3% up or 1% up or whatever, that affects people. I don't mean to be flippant about it, but the post-World War II American economy is just one of the most remarkable things in all of world history. And even when we try to screw it up, it just seems to find a way. And it's really remarkable. I'm not an economist, but I took enough economy classes that when you look historically, it really is amazing.
You're right. But I wouldn't play too much with tariffs because it really does affect the poorest in society the most in the United States and in Canada. So if we could not test that theory with tariffs anymore, that'd be great.
It goes to the most important part of all this, and I'll keep saying it because I want to get it in people's heads. The second worst thing you can do for the economy is have bad economic policy.
Exactly.
The most worst thing you can ever do is to have uncertainty.
Exactly.
Because you can adjust a bad policy, you can't adjust uncertainty. So at some point, the uncertainty is going to catch up with everybody. But bad policy, you can adjust to. Companies adjust to, especially with America, because... Yeah, and I'll leave it with this, but you can explain this. America is also unique in world policy because our government, we have so much turnover in our government. Other countries, China's been really great at this. You know, China bases their policy on our presidential elections and our midterms. They know, oh, well, you know, 2 years after a presidential election, the Congress is going to flip over. And they plan accordingly. The Ursula, her name escapes me, I apologize, the EU. She made a comment a couple of weeks ago is like, we're making policy for the next 3 years because there's going to be another presidential election.
Yeah.
The world, America forgets sometimes that the world knows that we're kind of unique in how fast we turn over government and they adapt to it. And the parliamentary systems and the EUs and the Chinas of the world, they know it too. I think some of this is people have figured out like, well, we can ride out Donald Trump. And the smart ones have decided to do that.
Yep, that's possibly true.
Unfortunately, Canada can't get away from us because we are quite literally geographically tied at the hip.
Exactly.
we can all get along. You can't have the Stanley Cup back, but other than that, we're going to get along good.
One day.
see, like this past year, we let you get close just so you get a taste. And then, you know, Florida is better at hockey than all of Canada. Just chew on it for a while. You know it's just true.
All your teams have Canadians on them, so whatever.
We put an expansion team in Vegas and they won a Stanley Cup.
This isn't a technical issue.
I just want that to hang there for our Canadian friends for a little while so they can fully enjoy the jouissance of that statement. See there? Who says I can't do French, huh? We're kidding, Canada. We love you very much, even our Quebec friends. Sabine, let people know where they can follow you, where they can keep up with you, what you got going on between now and when we get you back on Herd Tell, if they don't cancel us for all our Canadian shenanigans.
Well, you can find a lot about what we're doing at the Consumer Choice Center on all our socials, on our website. We've got that airport index that you were talking about. I think that's really interesting to a lot of your listeners. I'm on X. I talk a lot on X. I'm a yapper, professional yapper. So you can follow me on X at Sabine Chidiac. I stole my last name from before I was married. Got to change that soon. And hopefully I'll talk to you again soon.
We will. Go follow her on X. Follow the Consumer Choice Center. I wasn't joking. I do have quite a few friends that work there. They are excellent people. They do a lot of really good work. Make sure you're following all their stuff. Sabine, we will talk again soon if the new tariff laws mean we're still allowed to talk via electronic device. So we'll see you soon, my friend.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yes, ma'am.
All the music on Herd Tell is provided under a Creative Content License from MonsterCat.com.